I have a most interesting subject to discuss with you this morning. The Sydney Minister of our Lord and Savior.
Hi everybody, my name is Elliot Morgan.
And I am Peter Rollins.
And you are listening to the Fundamentalists podcast, which is a weekly podcast where a stand-up comedian and a philosopher sit down together to discuss the art and science and terror and fun of living life and living well. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think that's very accurate.
Dude, we did it. We launched a podcast.
Yeah, and we've already got three.
Yeah, four now.
This is number four.
Three and a tenth.
Yeah, we'd put 3 weeks into one day.
How are you feeling? What's been your reaction? How have you felt in the past week?
I've really loved it. I've loved hearing feedback, and people have been engaged, and I'm kind of enjoying that. Even though we just kicked off, we've kind of like, there's people who are listening and wanting to kind of go on this journey with us.
Yeah, it's really cool, man.
Yeah,
I didn't expect it to be as well received. I don't know why. I feel like maybe because it's such a niche interest of mine, I kind of was like, you know, I didn't expect. So many of people who have known me and watched me over the years have just been like, oh no, this is very, like, I think it makes sense to them, which is a good sign.
Oh yeah, very good.
Yeah, on my end, it's been very exciting. It's because people have listened to it, that means that I'm just realizing that I like stick my foot in my mouth all the time.
Yeah.
But I do that in regular life, so it just means I'm being true to myself.
Being honest
in the actual podcast. Do you have anything in life coming up that you would like to announce or talk about? I know you're doing Atheism for Lent right now.
Yeah, so that's just started, and if anybody wants to find out about that, they can go on my website. And it's really just an exploration of how close theism and atheism are and how they can enrich each other. You know, people think of them as enemies, but actually, in many ways, it's a passionate love affair they've had, where they've sometimes been fighting and sometimes been like together. And Atheism for Lent is kind of saying that whenever they're divorced from each other, they both are one-dimensional and boring. But when they're in relationship with each other, interesting things happen.
It's Batman and the Joker.
The Joker, exactly.
Or maybe Batman and Catwoman. Because Catwoman, they kind of go back and forth. Because Joker and Batman never really work together on many things, I don't think.
That's true. Although someone's going to point out some comic book where they actually did work together.
I was actually trying to remember that if in the Batman Lego movie, which I was watching on HBO Now, if they did that. But anyway, okay, cool. Yeah. Anything else going on?
You know, that's the main thing. I'm on tour at the moment with my friend Rob Bell. So we're about to head off to Texas for that.
Very cool.
But yeah, just
Houston, right?
Houston and Dallas and Santee. Not a well-known city in
Santee, Texas.
Santee, Texas. San Antonio.
Santee, Texas.
Yeah. And Austin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, Austin. Yeah, cool. Yeah.
And what about you? What have you been up to? What have you got going on?
Oh, thank you for asking, Pete. I have a show in Boston coming up this Wednesday. It's my birthday show. It's on February 21st at Laugh Boston. It's at 8 p.m. I think tickets are still available. As of now.
As in you've sold two tickets?
As I've sold, yeah. There are hundreds of tickets available.
It's actually selling really well, isn't that right?
It is,
looks,
man.
Like it's going to sell out.
Yeah, it's been nice. It may sell out. Who knows? They did the low ticket alert thing, which is always makes me feel good. And then on April 4th, I got a show on Crackers in Indianapolis. So if anybody is listening who likes stand-up comedy and lives in those areas, I'd love to see you. And Crackers is downtown. And I feel like there's something else, but that's about... Oh, there's one more thing, but I can't announce it. It's really, really exciting, but it involves the Valley Folk Kids, and so I got it.
You're allowed to say it? Is conflict of interest? Are you not allowed to mention?
How? I could never. I think we're going to announce it together and do that whole... Yeah, because otherwise they'll be like, oh, you're tar people. But anyway, it's really cool. It's very exciting. So
very cool.
That's that. So what are we talking about today, Pete?
Well, today is the subject of fantasy.
I love it.
What is fantasy? Why do we fantasize?
Steamy.
What are we doing when we fantasize?
Great. I feel like I should go ahead and just be like, if anybody knows me, just stop listening
yeah.
to this, because this is prime for me to just say something stupid.
Yeah, I'm kind of scared about what you're going to say.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I don't think
I know what goes on in this head, and it is not good.
It's not pretty. It's not pretty.
Not pretty. Not appropriate.
Yeah.
So we're talking about we're talking about why we fantasize and all that stuff. What I guess we can dive right into like what an actual fantasy is, because I and what kind of what do you mean by fantasy? Because fantasy can mean like, oh, I have a fantasy that I'm gonna be like, how is it different than a wish, I guess would be my
you could make a distinction between conscious fantasies like daydreams and that kind of thing, and unconscious fantasies, which are the things that we desire and we want, but we're often not even conscious of. They come out maybe in our dreams and whatnot. So you know, we have fantasies, sexual fantasies, and as you say, we have fantasies about, you know, being wealthy or being popular. And we also have fantasies that we're barely, if ever, aware of. Maybe, you know, we think about how much we would love to kill our brother or sister, which is a very common fantasy when you're an infant or a child. But as you grow up, you're told that that's not acceptable. Now, that doesn't stop you from wanting it. You just start to hide it from yourself.
Last night, I was hanging out with my brother and sister-in-law, and we were in a hot tub, and I put my cell phone on like the cover of the hot tub.
Oh yeah.
And my brother just decided to cover the hot tub, and so he just knocked my cell phone into the water, and me and my brother reacted exactly how me and my brother would react in that situation, which is we looked at it sinking into the water. And David's like, oh no. And I was like, oh, that's not good. And then we left it to David's wife, Emily, to be like, oh my gosh. And she like reached out and grabbed it. And remarkably, because we live in a space age, the cell phone is mostly fine. Like it's still usable. It's still got some character in it. But anyway, it's doing weird things, kind of possessed, kind of, it's got some demonic elements to it. But in that moment, I definitely was like, oh yeah, for sure. Like this is what that fantasy is.
I'm going to kill my brother. Yeah.
I really, and then he was like, why? It was that classic, like we both, like neither of us really care, but he was like, why'd you put it on the cover of the hot tub? And I was like, I don't know, man.
There's deflection right there. That's immediately, a good defense mechanism.
I was like, you're right, man.
It's your fault.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like,
Why do you have a mobile phone anyway? Why can you not just use pay phones everybody else?
You moron. You brought this upon yourself the moment you went into the Apple store.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was a fun thing. But it was like one of those classic, like neither of us really care, but we're definitely getting our our arguing out, but I don't think I've ever had a fantasy where I've wanted to kill my brother, truly, but you know, who knows, besides that moment. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, and sublimation's funny, is if you're able to joke about those fantasies, it brings them out, which is very healthy when you're actually able to joke about, I'd like to kill you now or whatever, but that actually really helps to dissipate the fantasy.
Yeah, there was, we didn't get that far, but there was definitely like, we were trying to order Postmates and they'd never ordered Postmates before. They'd never experienced it. And I was like, I can't wait to show you Postmates. Yeah. And then
it is like the future. When my mum came here from Northern Ireland, she'd never used Netflix, and it was like the future. And I thought, oh, it would be like the future when you're like watching regular TV, and suddenly your television has every film that's ever been made.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So Postmates is similar. It's like, you know, you go out and you have a food, and you also know how to order fast food from three or four locations.
Are you talking about me personally?
What's that? No, I'm talking about, like in the past.
That was a dig for all the crap that I order from Postmates.
No, I'm talking like when I was growing up, you know, you had some places, but Postmates is like everywhere. That's like the future.
It's unreal.
Yeah.
If there's any annoying sounds, everybody, sorry, I'm a little under the weather, so I'm drinking some honey chamomile tea. Anyway, yeah, but we were there like, we're going to order some Postmates, and I was like, oh, I'll do it. Oh, wait. And like then I sucked, you know, stuck myself on it. Anyway, whatever, who cares? Moving on. So there's fantasies that you don't know about.
Yeah, and fantasies that, you know, that you are very aware of. And fantasies start really early on. Obviously, like, in fact, one of the earliest, I think, this is kind of like theorists have watched kids and have theorized about this, but that when you're an infant, you're caught in a weird space. Like the basically the most valuable thing in the world, the most valuable thing to all of us, you know, more than money or fame or health or anything like that, is the desire of those we desire. So, you know, what we want is we want to be desired by the ones we desire, loved by the ones we love. And that's a very early experience. Yeah. And it goes with us for the rest of our lives. And infants and children, what we're trying to do very early on is work out how we are desirable to our caregivers, you know, what makes us desirable to them. So you see a lot of children will dress up, they'll play games, they're always trying to work out, you know, how do I fit in the desire of my mother or my father or whoever it is.
Does this like play into when you're a kid and how you have that like omnipotent sort of view where you like everything revolves around you when you're a kid, and so therefore whatever action your parents take toward you must inherently have something to do with you. So therefore it's on you to figure out, you know, play the game, do the thing to like try to please that person, because you're under the impression that it's up to you to earn essentially the love of the other.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose
does that make any sense?
I mean, in the sense of that very early on, you're noticing that desire is won and lost. I mean, that's a very early experience, is you go like, oh, my mother desires multiple things, or my father, and sometimes they desire each other, sometimes they don't. So very early on, you're realizing desire is this interesting commodity that's being passed around, and you are the focus of it, but you're not the sole focus of it. And in fact, it's very dangerous if you are the sole focus of it. But so, you know, realize
that over proximity stuff.
Yeah, it can be very damaging. But you begin to realize that your mother, your father have other desires outside of yourself. But that's also a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
There's an idea that, you know, you've got the demands of your family, which is what, you know, I can tell you if you're my kid what to do. And you can obey all the demands. But desire is so much more ethereal and difficult to grasp. And so even things like if you've got a kid and they come back from school, or say you are the kid and you beat somebody up in school because they were picking on you, and your dad says to you, you shouldn't have done that. That's a terrible thing to do. You should never use violence. So that's a demand, and the demand is you should never use violence. But sometimes there can be a little bit of desire that seems to be like your father's proud of you.
For sure, like a hell yeah.
Yeah,
a hell yeah. Atta boy.
Yeah, so you're already experiencing the difference between demands and desire, between what you're told you should do and what your parents really want you to do.
I know, that's so funny, dude. I remember that being like a teenager and being very, especially in like the Christian conservative fundamentalist world, it's very like, you know, because like I grew up with that, but my mom mostly was into it, and then my dad was kind of loosely into it, but and not very much at all. But then, like, as I would, you know, enter into puberty and, you know, girls and all that stuff, there was always this sort of thing where it was like spoken. It's like, no, you are very strict, like you're very like, but there's always that kind of like, you know, like that nudging or whatever. And I remember just being like, what is going on here? Like something. And it really, really, really stressed me out, because I was like, well, I have to obey the kind of spoken rules, even though those spoken rules are only there because deep down they're everyone's like, yeah, you're gonna.
I mean, there's nothing worse really than parents who have a child who actually does what they're told. You know, the parents who go, listen, don't go out and drink and sleep around. But then weirdly, when they find out that you're not out drinking and chatting with girls and doing that stuff, they're kind of a bit disappointed.
Yeah, sometimes. That's, dude, I think I was an insanely obedient kid,
yeah.
And I think that like didn't do me any favors.
Yeah.
I talked about that in like some of the stand-up stuff, where it's like, I don't think I say it anymore, but the theme was like making sure you screw up a little bit, like
yes.
Do a little bit to like push the envelope, because that's the whole point of all of it.
Absolutely. There's a commandment in the Bible, which is thou shalt have no other gods before you. And one of the ways to read this is actually
before you or before me.
Before you shall have no other gods before me. Oh yeah, so God's saying have no other gods.
That's a Freudian slip. You think I'm a deity?
Yes, I do. But the interesting thing about this saying is, if you take it literally, it's saying you shall have no other gods in front of me. As in, yeah, of course, go on and have other gods. Do it. Go out and do your thing, but just don't do it in front of me.
That's
be
funny.
Discreet. Yeah. So it's you know, there's
idol worship is fine. Just worship me the most.
Yeah, and just do it quietly, discreetly, and which is of course what the parents, a good parent does. You know, they give you the rules, but they also say, well, you can discreetly disobey them, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing worse than having parents who are militaristic in the sense of there is no transgressive ability.
Uh-huh.
So even within the Jewish religion, you see all of this kind of play between the demand and desire of God. So it's in psychology and it's in theology, interestingly.
I remember in growing up, this is something that, like, it took me a long time to figure out, not growing up, I guess, but like the difference between now and when I was a young lad, as opposed to this weary person that I am now. But the idea that, like, if you lust after a woman, even if you do it in your head, that's considered infidelity in the eyes of the Lord. Or something like that. It's considered, you know, cheating in some way. Like, if you have an impure thought, like, that's bad. And as I've gotten older, I've been like, no. Like, yeah. I'm gonna, there's gonna be thoughts that are impure. And like, I remember just beating myself up for the thoughts that you weren't supposed to have, like the sexual thoughts, the whatever, the fantasies, and being like, oh, I'm not supposed to have these things. But then it's like, of course, like, I totally had them. And so it was just, it's been like a interesting process of being like, okay, that thought is not great and it's not good and I'm not condoning it. But at the same time, I'm not going to, like, you know, harp on myself for all that stuff.
But we are by definition fantasy beings. This was one of the core insights of Freud. You know, people think, Zizek says this very well, but people think that what Freud was saying was that, you know, whenever we're doing anything, painting a great painting, building a building, or, you know, making a TV show, we're really thinking about sex. It's all about, you know, attracting the other person. There's libidinal desire, sexual desire. But no, Freud wasn't saying that at all, really. Freud noticed that human beings, to have sex, need something else. They need fantasy. So Freud's thing was, why is it that human beings are so bad at sex that we require a phantasmic support in order to do it? So other animals don't need a phantasmic support in order to have sex, but human beings, we seem to need fantasy in order to sustain the sexual act, to make it enjoyable. And that's a really interesting thing.
Why? What's the answer? Why do we, why, yeah. Why?
So, well, the first thing I think to say about it is fantasy begins often, you know, Lacan says, by the child trying to bridge the difference between demand and desire.
Okay.
So the kid is trying to work out, you know, there's certain rules about what I have to do and behavior, but also what is desired of me and what makes me desirable. And what they do is they begin to fantasize what that might look like. What does the other want of me? So the weird thing is, fantasy starts not as what you want, but that what you think the other wants of you.
Ugh.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's difficult. It's weird because we think fantasies are our own. We think fantasies are the most intimate thing about us. But the trick is, when you hear people's fantasies, they tell you more about how they think they need to be in the world in order to be desirable.
Ugh, you're just making me go through things that I've thought, and it's not good.
that's why some of us are tyrannized by our fantasies, that actually we wouldn't want to do our fantasies, that we actually sometimes feel that we are inhabited by the fantasies of others.
Well, now, when you talk about fantasy, like, you know, the really super kind of Freudian dark crap where you're like, I want to kill my brother or sister and all that stuff, or kill my sibling in some way, or I want to murder somebody. Let's just say murder. Like, when you fantasize about murder.
Yeah.
Which I don't think I've ever done, but I've definitely fantasized death in different capacities. But are you saying that, like, that applies to that too, where it's like, even if your fantasy, like, if your true fantasy is to murder, like, your sibling or something, is that you saying that the world sees you as someone who could destroy something, or, like, what's the connection there, or is it just a different type? Are we talking about a different facet of fantasy?
or it could be, you know, that your brother, your sister, your sibling is a threat to the desire of your parents. So, you know, there's jealousy. So again, the fantasy is not, you know, you're thinking about killing someone, but it still relates to the idea of how can I be the only one to my parents, or how can I get the desire of that, or who's a threat to that. So I think, like, early on, I think it's useful to think about how the child is just trying to work out how to be and have the desire of the other, how to be desirable to the mother or the father. And there's threats to that, and sometimes the fantasy, you know, the murder stuff. Like, of course, the Oedipal story is all about you want to sleep with your mother, so you want to kill your father because your father is a threat to your sure. relationship to your mother. I mean, that's a very superficial reading of it, but that's the original story.
This make me think, and I don't know if this has anything to do with it, and if it doesn't, I'm so sorry. But the thing that happens with people where, like, a lot of times they end up dating somebody or marrying somebody who isn't right for them, and everyone knows they're not right for them, and they know that the person isn't right for them, and they continue to go out with the same jerk or the same loser or the same person, and then they complain, and then they go, well, I want somebody like this because my dad was, did it. And then the moment they describe their mom or their dad, it's almost inevitably the exact same person that they're finding over and over again, but they're only finding the bad qualities.
That's unconscious fantasy, weirdly, where we play the same relationship. When different people come into our lives, but weirdly we play out the same thing. Like, the crazy thing is, there's some of us like are only attracted to people who, say, ignore us, right? But then here's the weird thing. It's not just that you go, why am I always going out with people who, you know, mistreat me? Weirdly, if you meet someone who doesn't mistreat you, you find that you don't even desire them.
Yeah.
So you can come sometimes even make the person start kind of like being a bit of an asshole, because weirdly, that is a replaying, as you say, of a primordial scene. It's a replaying of an something else.
Yeah, it's like the Groucho Marx. I don't want to be a part of any club that would have me as a member. Like, the moment somebody is like, yeah, da, 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 and then they're like, yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a very common thing people have.
You know? I have that constantly.
Yeah,
every day. Like, oh, now that you're not, all right, okay, cool. It's that like earning of the, even if it's like the I don't know, Starbucks barista or something.
Yeah,
like Mr. Nice Person. Then when they're nice, I'm like, okay, that was nice. We didn't have a good day, but the excitement is being like, hi, I'm friendly, please like me.
And there's no way we escape this. Like, this is called repetition. Repetition is where you repeat the same behaviors. And
let me write that down. Repetition
is where you get your pencils out, everybody. But there's a famous phrase, if you don't know history, you're condemned to repeat it.
Yeah, yeah.
In the same way for individuals, it's kind of the same. If we don't know our history, if we repress that, it repeats. So not knowing your past, in a sense, means you're condemned to eternally repeat it.
That's so crazy, because I have such a, we've talked about this a little bit, but I have such a bad memory that it's like, I worry about that, where I'm like, do I even know my, but I think I do. I think I just don't think about it very much. Remembering and thinking about it are two different things, I guess.
Yeah, and people carry their past with them. That's another interesting thing, is that the past is never history. And that's why you can tell a lot about someone's past, because your past clings to you in the present. It clings to you in your activities, in the tapping of your finger, in your anxieties.
Yeah, there's, it's like the I feel like there's, as pessimistic as this sounds, there's something to be said for like the feelings of inadequacy or insecurity or whatever. I think in my experience, they don't go away. They just all you have control over literally is your behavior and how you handle them. But like, it's weird because I think that something gets, it's just all in there in your DNA, and then it's like it lashes out. And for me, I'm always like, well, why do I feel this way? And I would be like, I shouldn't feel that. But then when I do, I'm like, oh, this is because of this, and it was instilled in me at a young age by society and upbringing and all that. So
yeah, I mean, sometimes there's an idea called enjoying your symptom, which kind of means that sometimes it's not about overcoming your symptom.
Okay, yes, you can't just let me not. If I mumble masturbation and then you just move right past it, then that's what.
Well, that's a common thing. You mumble masturbation a lot, so I just ignore it.
It's you know, that's my method. You know, everyone has their thing. I like to say the word. Okay, anyway.
So yeah, enjoying your symptom is where you go, oh, I've got this tick, for example, or I've got this issue, but somehow I'm going to make it useful. Like, maybe I'm trying to think of an example, but like comedians do it. Like, if you've got certain ticks, or you get angry a lot, and a comedian's able to then make jokes about it, they're able to make it into their set, and they're actually able to make money from it. So
well
Well, yeah, not often. No, you'll get there someday.
Yeah, thanks, but, man. Best case scenario.
But comedians, I mean, that's why comedians are often very depressed people, because they find a very healthy defense, which is sublimation, which is getting on stage and talking about their shit. But so that's a very, so they're almost, they're enjoying their symptom. The thing that would have otherwise destroyed them, might have made them commit suicide, might have destroyed their lives, they have found a way to actually let it work for them.
Provided they're actually funny and know what they're
doing.
Dude, there's nothing sadder than like a guy who gets on stage and you can just tell he's like heard this is a healthy thing to do, or she's heard that this is the healthy thing to do. And God, I know so many people, they get up there and they're just like garbage, and then they like think that they're doing this sort of like grandiose, and then it becomes therapy.
Yeah,
and it's like, that's this, don't turn the audience into like your therapist, because they're not going to give you the approval. I've seen some absolute meltdowns on stage, like where it's just like, dude, you got, I mean, and I've done things where I've just been like, well, clearly this is coming from a place of, you know, I was doing a punch up writing session a couple weeks ago, and we were doing, there was some line that I wanted to punch up where it was like, I knew it wasn't a good joke, but
by the way, a punch up session is where you take a script that's already funny, but your job is to make it funnier.
Yes, right? Yeah. Good call. And so, it's me and my friends, and then there's like the director, and then there's some producers, and we there's this line that one of the characters said where it's like, "Or do you have a girlfriend?" And they're like, "Oh, I'm such and such, not in a relationship, but in the moment, you know, I'm feeling really happy." And then I was like, and I like mumbled something, and then the director was like, "Wait, what did you say?" I mumbled masturbation. And then we're like, "Elliot, besides masturbation, what did you just say?" And I was like, "Oh, I was just gonna say the line, like, I don't remember exactly what it is, so even in saying it now, it's not gonna be funny, but it was something along the lines of like, no, I'm not in a relationship, I'm happy." And
that's good. That's a good line.
And yeah, and the director was just like, and like people kind of laughed, and they're like, okay. They're like, "Elliot, I think you put a little bit of yourself into that that joke right there." And then my friend Lee was like cracking up. And then,
is that called punching down?
Yeah, that's punching down. That's making, how do we make the script worse and sadder? Yeah. But it was one of those things where it's like, oh no, that is totally like that, me being that sort of like, which I don't believe, and I'm not into that. Like, you know, obviously, everybody, you know, who knows what we believe, but like, I definitely had a moment after where I was like, why was that the joke that I went to?
Yeah.
Of like, of course I'm not in a relationship, I'm happy. And it's, you know, it's so cynical, and it's so over the plate cynical that I don't like it, and it feels sour, and it's not what I want to put out into the world. But clearly something in me was like,
Something's coming out. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but, and you're absolutely right about it. Like, it's not just having suffering alone. One of my, Kierkegaard, there's one of my favorite quotes of him. He says, "What is a poet? A poet is someone who screams and cries in agony, but whose lips are so formed that when they cry out, beautiful music is formed."
It's the best quote in the world.
It is the
best quote in the world. That, and I can't, it's okay. We should do a whole episode on just fun quotes, because it's really nice. But like that one and the Groucho Marx one, I think are probably my two favorite quotes in the world.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, Kierkegaard had some very Groucho Marx. I mean, they're very kind of like sounding quotes.
Really?
Yeah, he was very acerbic and funny.
Yeah, I love that. Oh my god, and just how nice that sound, how like that's like a strong quote.
It's so good. And then he goes on to say, and he says, "His lips are so formed that when they cry, beautiful music is formed." And he says, "So when we say to the poet, 'Sing to us again,' we are saying, 'May new disasters befall you.'" But the thing about the quote is that the poet, they have these lips that take screams and agony and make them beautiful. So I can't get up on stage with a guitar and just think that because of my pain that I can bring it to the surface, I'll be able to play the guitar. You have to learn the guitar.
Same
with the comedian, has to learn all of the skills of the comedian. But if they don't have that ability to touch the core of their darkness, all of the technical expertise will count for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But if they don't have the technical expertise, then yes, just therapy on a stage.
I know. I love it. I love it so much. I love stand-up very, very much. When it's like that, when you get that perfect mix of like you know, and I'm working on it, but it's fun. I love the process. Yeah. Do you ever, when you're just out of curiosity, when you're writing stuff or like doing these, you know, talks or lectures, do you ever think in terms of quotes? Like, are you ever like, after I die, what's the quote that people are going to be like, so-and-so Peter Rollins? Like, if have what would be, because I know this is for sure definitely narcissistic, very like branding, but is there anything where you're like, I hope I'm known for this one thing that I said one time, or you just like let other people, you probably can't say that, even if you had, it'd be like it'd be the most, you should never answer this question.
Yeah.
Even if you have the answer, you definitely shouldn't.
Yeah.
Because if you tell me and then you die, 100% I'm making a joke where I go, oh, you know, as Pete once said, my favorite quote from myself is,
but there are people who will, you know, do quotes and then quote themselves. Mm-hmm, I haven't done that. I would do that.
They'd put anonymous. Oh, like, oh yeah, well,
that's quite good. Anonymous. I'll maybe do that. If you ever see that on my Twitter feed, you'll know it's me.
In like high school and college, anonymous. Yeah. They don't know. They're still trying to find out who said this nugget of wisdom.
Yeah.
Something about fantasies that I think is interesting that I've experienced in my life is when I can make up crap in my head so easily. And I've done this in situations. I do it less now, but in like I don't know if this pertains to fantasy, but I make so many assumptions about a particular person that are either negative or positive that like whoever the person is completely lost. And I've had this experience professionally and personally and all this stuff. And it's like, I don't know what that is where it's like, I look back and especially in relationships that I have now where I'm like, oh, I was just like completely in my own head and making this thing up and projecting onto
the other person.
Yeah, but is that not really, that's not really a fantasy necessarily, but it definitely feels like it because I'm walking around going like, well, this is happening and they're doing this and they think that and they're da 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 da, and it's like, all a bunch of crap.
But that is a form of like, it's called imaginary desire, but we're in a relationship. And it's very common, most of us do it at the very beginning of a relationship, is that you have a fantasy frame of what causes your desire, what evokes your desire, and then someone fulfills that to some extent, even if it's just they've got the color of hair, that or the sound of a voice, or
something that triggers.
And
I meant it more even negatively, though.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Fantasizing like a negative, sort of making somebody into like a... almost like just a totalitarian, like a
evil, like nasty thing.
Evil to their core, and then I know. We're kind of circling around.
Yeah, I mean that is. I mean, again, that is something that's evoking in you because, you know, if we're indifference, kind of means that it's not connecting with us. But yeah, I suppose if you hate someone, for a good reason, you still have to wonder why, because there's things that are annoying that won't annoy me,
yeah,
that would annoy you, or vice versa. So the things that annoy us tell us a lot about ourselves.
Cool. Yeah. So this is fun, man. This is a good subject. I'm having a great time.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, please, after you.
Oh, I was going to say, because you brought up something about, you know, fantasies, their desires that we have that seem foreign to us. I think there was something you said about that.
Sure.
I just wanted to draw something up about that, because often whenever, you know, you're trying to please your mother or your father all your life, if your mother or father dies, again, an interesting Freudian insight is that you don't stop having to please them. In fact, it can get even worse. You can want to please them even more. Even though they don't exist, you find yourself weirdly always going out with somebody who they would want you to go out with.
Yeah, yeah.
Or taking a job that they would want, and you're not even aware of it. So you end up being with someone or doing a job, and you've desired it, as in you've chosen it, but you don't desire your desire. Because in a weird way, you are, what you've done is you have been penetrated by the other person's desire.
Oh, terrible, terrible. Penetrated.
I knew some
strong word.
A strong word, because I know there's a girl I know who, she wanted to be an artist, but she did law.
Yeah.
And she also, and she was always incredibly well turned out, makeup, and always looked beautiful, but also felt oppressed by doing that.
Yeah. So
both of those things, being a law student and always being this very well turned out when she went out, were her desires. But she didn't desire her desire. She found her desires oppressive. And when we talked about it, what started to come out is how she had been kind of, she'd inculcated the desires of others, of her family.
I have a note on that. Let me do a quick plug for our sponsor.
Well, let's do it.
This podcast is brought to you guys by trywink.com/thefundamentalists.
Oh yeah, Elliot got it wrong. So we probably lost out in tens of thousands of dollars.
Hundreds of thousands of dollars
because you didn't say the.
Because I didn't say the. Imagine all the people who wanted wine and then were not able to get it, or they got it and they didn't get a discount. You can go to trywink.com, which is WINC/thefundamentalists, and it's a wine company that sends wine bottles to your door, and they're really good and they look cool.
If you want,
I wish that wasn't my mate, but I'm like, they look so cool.
But see, this is what we're doing here. Like, you're gonna, if you want to win over our desire, if you desire our desire, yes, then buy this wine.
Yes.
So there you go. That's
as we dissect capitalism and we try to free ourselves from the desire to escape, and we try to confront our darkness. Definitely join us in that, and not confront your darkness with a bottle of wine.
A bottle of wine. You see this in advertising all the time, by the way, is that a lot of advertising shows somebody desiring an object, and they try to get someone who we would find desirable, or an authority figure that we'd find desirable. So what you're interested in. Who's that?
Matthew McConaughey.
Yes, exactly.
I saw a picture of him, with him. He's wearing a leather jacket and he's drinking like Wild Turkey whiskey. And I was like, God dang, that looks like some good whiskey. Oh, wow. I was like, I would definitely want to drink.
Is he? He's the guy from Home Alone.
Matthew McConaughey?
Yeah. No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
He is?
Yes.
Oh,
Matthew McConaughey is the little kid. And
yes, in Home and Away.
Yeah, Home and Away. Matthew McConaughey is the little kid.
And I don't know if you're taking the piss out of me now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For sure you're thinking of Macaulay Culkin.
Yes. I was wondering why him drinking some whiskey would make you go, him. Oh, hell yeah.
Anytime I see a 7-year-old drinking whiskey, I'm like, hell yeah, I'm drinking that whiskey.
I thought it was weird. I'm glad I asked you, otherwise I would have found that a bit bizarre.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked too. But it's Matthew McConaughey, as in, Interstellar.
Oh.
Dallas Buyers Club. I think.
Yeah, and, I haven't seen those. I think I've seen Interstellar.
A billion other movies.
Yeah. But he's cool. He's a cool guy.
Cool guy.
Yeah.
True Detective. Did you watch the first?
That was very good.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's him.
Oh, he's very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's him drinking whiskey, and I saw it, and I was like, God. I mean, for one, I'm under the weather, so I'm like not drinking it. But like when I'm under the weather, I'm always just like, I can't wait to like sip that, because he's like around a campfire, and
see,
I'm like, yeah.
I'm already wanting this, and I bet you you're just talking about this. Other people are going, oh, I want this. Like tonight, I'm going like, let's have a bit of whiskey.
You know what's even better than whiskey? Those wine, and you can get that at trywink.com/thefundamentalist. And if you do, you get $25 off. So I had a thought, which was Ben Folds has this song called Ben Folds 5. It's on their newest album, and it's called You Were Away Even When You Were Here, and it's him to his father, singing to his father, and you can imagine what the song's about. It's called You Were Away Even When You Were Here, and he has this line at the end where he's like,
his dad was a pilot
yeah. And even when he was there, he was away. But he basically, there's lines like, he wakes up this morning to be older than you were, fresh white snow for miles. And I've noticed this even with my aunts and uncles and my parents, when they reach the age at which their father passed away, there is kind of this like symbolic freeing that happens where, and it's sung about in that song where it's like, oh, you don't have to be held back by that oppressive thing anymore. Yeah. And it's so interesting. It's like, it happens, and maybe it's not, maybe it doesn't happen. Yeah. Maybe they think it's going to happen, but it never actually does. But it's so interesting that like, that's one more like rite of passage that people go through where it's like, oh, now I'm older than, now I'm older than my parent when they pass away, and how that is supposed to free them, or the death of them is supposed to free them, or getting the job is supposed to free them. And it's like, how do you just do it? Like, how do you just get, I talk about this a lot. It came up a lot in therapy where, this past week, where it was just sort of like going into the insecurities and like all that stuff, and like figuring out what your actual, how you want to live your life on a conscious level, and then enacting it, but it's a constant fight against the desires that you have on an unconscious level to return to those repetitive behaviors.
And sometimes we sometimes naturally, as you say, like you know, find a way to let some of those things go. And sometimes we need help because we just can't do it, because we're inundated by the ghosts of other people's desires that they infiltrate us. I have a good friend of mine, Todd DeLay. He's written very well on this. He wrote a book called God is Unconscious, which is very good.
Todd's awesome.
Yeah, Todd's a good guy. But we often, it's very difficult for us to come to desire what we desire, come to work through all of those things. It's a life work.
It's crazy. So when it comes to fantasies, what's a fantasy of yours that you maybe have had in the past?
Wow.
That's not to elicit. That's not too,
yes. Yeah. For our, family friendly podcast.
Clean lyrics.
Clean lyrics. Well, yeah, I'll tell you, this is a really simple one. Like my mum, and I, remind me, we've got to talk about mimetic desire, right? This is a version of it.
That's
but my mum,
okay.
No, what's no, that? No, masturbation, no, did you good. Say?
Yeah. The title of this episode is Masturbation, did you say?
That could be the title
maybe
of this.
We'll, yeah, we'll talk
I think
about
actually.
It.
My mum always loved James Bond. She always loved James Bond, and funnily enough, John Wayne. There is a massive picture of John Wayne in the bathroom of my mum and dad's house.
That's love.
And it's still there. And to this day, I cannot urinate without a picture of John Wayne.
Staring at you?
Staring at me. It's a really weird thing.
Yeah.
But no, so mum loved John Wayne.
That's a very strange thing.
Yeah. She loved John Wayne. She loved James Bond. And I think, you know, deep down, like I love James Bond myself now, but it's partly because I saw my mum's desire for James Bond. So I think in my fantasy, I want to, like when I go to Vegas, I'm walking around thinking I look like, you know. I can't even remember the name of any of the James Bonds. Who's the latest one? Daniel Craig.
Craig.
And casinos don't have mirrors because the whole point
Macaulay Culkin.
But casinos don't have mirrors because they don't want you to see yourself because, you know, you're in the fantasy of who you are. But then I remember going to a casino and I was thinking it was going to be like in James Bond. I didn't realize I'd see so many oxygen tanks. And,
oh, sure.
And people.
You didn't know you'd be confronted with a wall of sadness.
Yes.
And despair.
It, you know, the film's
you
light. To me,
that,
the movies lie to me. I was like, whoa, what where are all the tuxedos?
Oh my god.
And the
gosh.
Ball gowns. So in some respects I often think that weirdly James Bond is kind of like my view of what it is to be a man, not consciously but maybe unconsciously.
That makes sense. You wear a lot of cool leather jackets and a lot of
tuxedos. Yeah, straight here. You wear your tuxes on a like when you're lounging around the house.
Yeah, as soon as I said it, I was like, man, it doesn't really connect at all. I had a thought.
You like to kill people.
You like to kill people, yeah. Usually your brother. It's a repressed desire.
Well, my brother once, by the way, I have these toy soldiers. You know the wee toy plastic soldiers?
Yeah. The little green men?
Yeah, yes. And he put them on the coals of an open fire, and he lit the fire. And I came into the room and I watched as my little soldiers melted on the pieces of coal.
And then...
Still with me. Traumatized.
Really?
Traumatized.
So funny, the things. I mean, that would be... I mean, to see the little green men melt is kind of gross and traumatic. I mean, that's...
And then he picked them up with a poker and then put them onto my skin.
I don't believe that part.
No, that is not true.
Funny though that when you pee, John Wayne is looking at you because it's like you're at your most vulnerable, then you're looking at like the epitome of like American masculinity.
Yeah, and it wasn't the young John Wayne. Because I don't really know John Wayne because I'm not.
Is there a young John Wayne? I think John Wayne was born 65 years old. I've never seen a young John Wayne. Is there?
Right? Well, that's okay then, because this guy definitely looks 65 years old.
Okay,
that's
funny. Yeah. I feel like I know exactly what photo it is, because it's the only photo of John Wayne. It's him wearing a cowboy hat and staring at grimacing at the camera. I imagine because I met your mom, and she's the sweetest lady, so I imagine your home, when I imagined the John Wayne photo, I imagined it in a bathroom with like the walls being like a dark green, and then there's like a fire burning, and then somebody's
in the bathroom.
In the bathroom, fireplace.
Bathroom fire. Yeah, in Ireland we have fireplaces everywhere. The bathroom fire. Could you put some more coal in the bathroom fire?
Yeah. Front yard has a fireplace. Yeah. It's really nice. Yeah. But yeah, I imagine it's just a very cozy home, and it's like very. It smells really nice and smells like food when you walk in. Is that what it's like?
Yeah. Listen, I used to live in a house that was the epitome of that. And it was a cottage.
Now we're talking fantasy.
Oh yeah, it was on a street where all the other houses were not like cottages, but it used to be the kind of part of a massive mansion way in the past. Mm-hmm. It was where like servants lived or whatever, and it's funny because it's exactly what people would imagine an Irish house would be.
That's like what's his name? Thomas Kincaid. You want to talk about fantasy? Oh, Thomas Kincaid is the painter who did the fantasy, the fantastic, idealized kind of like cobblestone street in Christmas time with like snow covering everything and street lamps on and the fire from the fireplace, your smoke is coming out. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, because didn't he like, he was so successful that they opened up shops all over.
Yeah.
I don't know much about him, but I thought that was an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, and my, and very Christian, and he like put, you know, little tiny Bible verses and everything, I think. Yeah. Or at least some, or maybe he didn't, but maybe he was just very quote unquote Christian. I remember like one Christmas as a kid, I bought my mom for Christmas like a Thomas Kincaid coffee mug, and I was really proud of that as a gift because I thought she'd really like it, and she still has it, and it's actually still a very nice looking coffee mug. But it does do something to you where you see that kind of thing and you're like, oh
yeah,
that like quintessential. And it's so weird too because it always comes from the same era of like 19, I don't know, what
yeah.
would that be, like 1930s or I don't know, like
don't
the
know.
Thomas Kincaid. Anyway, I know the style.
And that, the thing about fantasy, and you see it in the Kincaid photos, is a fantasy is a way of covering over a lack. So, you know, whenever between demand and desire, and we don't know who we are or what makes us desirable, those questions that a lot of neurotics have as well, what makes me desirable, is a very common question. A lot of people, you know, ask, why do you love me? You know, what is it about me that makes me lovable? And it can never be like one or two things. Like, what is it that actually makes me desirable? But fantasy is a way of escaping the anxiety of that. So a fantasy offers an idea of wholeness and completeness. So our fantasies kind of like help us escape from the difficulties of life. So Kincaid, I don't know this, but I bet you, I would almost put money on this, that his work sells better at times of crisis, either in economics and in politics. Just like musicals do a lot better whenever there's an economic downturn, because you go into a cinema and you have this purely phantasmic, everything is perfect and beautiful.
Comedies do better after tragedies.
Say it again.
Comedies do better after tragedies.
Oh, is that what they
say?
Yeah,
they do say that. Yeah, because I remember the first, blanking on it, the Ben Stiller movie with the blue lightning thing.
You know, Ben Stiller. Zoolander. Yeah.
So the first one came out right after, I think, 9/11, and then I remember them talking about that, and then there was some tragedy that came out right before the second one.
That
is connected, but I remember them talking about, like, back in 2001, them saying that, like, after tragedies, comedies tend to do.
Yeah, because we want a type of escape.
Yeah.
Although, interestingly, like, it's like pop music, when you've gone through something very traumatic, going out and listening to pop music, it can help you forget about your suffering. The problem is it doesn't help you work through it. So the next day you feel crap again. But a good singer-songwriter will help you work through your suffering. So a good musician, they'll talk about love and life and death in a way that helps you connect with those elements within yourself.
Hmm.
Whereas a pop song's all about, you know, the fantasy of getting revenge or getting money or getting this or that. And that, I say that, there's nothing wrong with it, because sometimes we want to listen to pop music and forget. But you listen to someone like Ben Folds or Bob Dylan or whoever, and in a sense, they help you connect with the lack rather than cover over it.
Good examples, too.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I think about that with my Weezer boys.
Like, oh yeah,
their new music
yeah.
is very poppy, and I love it, and it's very fun. But it's definitely like pure escapism.
Yeah.
And then I listen to like other things. I've been listening to this new band called Rilo Kiley recently, and a lead singer named Jenny Lewis, and I really.
It sounds like that. You always remind when you mentioned them the other day, and the first thing I thought was Kylo Ren.
Yeah,
which is
I know.
The guy from Star Wars.
Yeah. So. Yeah, Rilo Kiley, I think, came and went before Kylo Ren was ever invented. But it is funny that they're like so similar.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of funny.
So where do these things, these fantasies come from that we have? Like, if I, because some of mine are pretty dark, but also very, very specific.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very colorful.
Yes. We often, yeah, we revolve around the same fantasies. That's a funny, sexual fantasies that are very often very similar and et cetera, et cetera. In one sense, I try to think of it like when you're having a fantasy, you think it's for you, but actually it's a good question to ask is, who, like, think of it like a theater, and you're the director, and your fantasy is what's happening on the stage, and there's actually an audience. So who is the audience? So even if you take something in, like you want to be rich, for example, you go, well, there's nothing inherently desirable about that. I mean, there's desirable elements, you can have nicer stuff, but the fact that that animates you, is there somebody you're having that fantasy for? Like, is that maybe your family wanted you to be rich, or you thought that's what would make you desirable. So our fantasies are often staged for other people. And it's interesting to go, like, if I want to be James Bond, who do I want to be James Bond for? Like, who is looking at my fantasy?
I remember that Bible quote, which is what you call them, Bible quotes. Uh-huh. When the Lord is talking to Adam, and he's like, who told you were naked? And it's always, that's just what made me think of. Who told you you want to be rich? Who told you?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know what? There's a really good reading of the Genesis story. I'm very interested in that mythology. But it's connected to mimetic desire, which I mentioned briefly.
Let's talk about that, because you wanted to bring that up.
And it connects with the story and the story of Adam and Eve. It's all in there. But mimetic desire is the idea that we learn what to desire by looking at what someone else desires.
In pneumatic, is that what
you mean? Mimetic.
Mimetic.
To
Macaulay Culkin, Matthew McConaughey, mimetic.
Mimetics.
Masturbation.
And masturbation. The four M's.
Bears, Beats, Battlestar Galactic. Okay.
So mimetic desires. So weirdly, like, if you are attracted to somebody, that person could very easily become more attractive to me. Not because I'm attracted to them, but I'm attracted to how you're attracted to them.
Ha.
So this happens a lot. Yeah.
I'm going to test that out next time we're hanging out.
Okay, yeah.
I'm going to say, look at that person over there.
Oh, you can actually do that weird stuff. You can kind of pretend to desire. Well, that's what advertising is, people pretending to desire things to evoke our real desire. You do that with kids, by the way. Every parent does it. Whenever you're trying to get your kid to eat, Brussels sprouts, you're like, oh, that tastes amazing. And the poor kid doesn't know, the only way they learn how to desire is through your desire.
Poor kid, he has no idea that he's eating trash food.
Yeah.
Not trash food, but...
They have a good food that tastes like trash, but yeah. So the child is always looking at what does the parent desire. There's a big thing where a kid won't know how to respond in a situation, so they'll say, look to their mother and see what their mother's face does, and then they will mimic that to whether it's a safe or unsafe environment. So it's about mimesis, mimicking. And that's how we learn to desire, is to...
I studied mimesis in college. There's like anaphase, telophase. It's a process by which cells...
This has got really boring all of a sudden, really quickly. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's a cell reproduction. It was boring. That's all I can remember. I can't even make the joke because I'm boring myself. It's mitosis.
Mitosis? Is that... I didn't even know. All right.
It's mitosis and meiosis, so whichever one you would prefer.
Oh, yeah. Wow. This is edutainment.
Cell duplication, yep. Yeah, that's what we're doing here, is edutainment. Anyway, sorry.
Oh, yeah, so that's kind of the interesting... So the idea is that I see what you do. And by the way, this creates conflict. So because our desire is for... two things. Our desire is for the desire of the other, and our desire is for what the other desires. These are various ways our desire functions. So that always causes conflict, because if I'm always desiring what other people desire, then we'll get into fights. We'll get into fights because, you know, there's limited resources and we're all attracted to, say, the same people or the same things. Mm. And so what one has to do is develop rituals to break the violence that comes from mimetic desire.
So give me an example, because that was a lot of cool... That was a cool sentence.
Okay, wow.
Loved that sentence. Develop rituals to break the what?
to break the violence that's created through mimetic desire.
- Peter Rollins, rest in peace.
Yes, there's the quote.
We found it.
Whereas yours is masturbation and...
Yeah, masturbation.
Meiosis.
I'm not in a relationship. I'm happy. Yeah. So what would be an example of a ritual that would help break the violence of a mimetic desire?
So the main one is called scapegoating.
Okay.
So scapegoating is where a conflict that is within a community, the you find some external enemy or some external thing. It used to be a literal goat. That's why it's called the scapegoat. And you put all of the violence onto that. You say that's the problem. So you all unify around hating the same thing. So we're in conflict with each other. There's internal conflict within our community because we're desiring the same stuff and all of that. And so what we do is we find an external enemy and then we all blame them. And that creates community.
That makes
again.
It better.
Makes it better. Now, and scapegoating is not a healthy thing, but it's one of the basic, very primal ways we deal with resolving conflict.
That release valve thing.
That release valve.
Put it all on that one thing.
Yeah, to scapegoat. So and it's connected with desire.
Do you ever flip the script and you go, okay, you know, if I'm, excuse me. If you're aware that your own desires are, or your own fantasies are, either or, I guess, are a product of somebody else's, or do you ever try to flip the script and go, okay, when you look at other people, like, I guess, how does it change on a day-to-day basis how you perceive other people if you know that the majority of the things they do are for the desire of like their parent or something, but they don't know it. Like, I, you know what I think it does? If I had to like give like a take anything away, it seems like it would give you more compassion for people.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like, it really does. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I look at a lot of the people that I know and the people that I get frustrated with, and then just people in general, when I see them out and about in the world, and the first inkling is to be very cynical and to be like, why did it? But then it's like, if you look at it through that perspective, it really kind of just it humanizes people. And yeah. You're like, oh, we really are all just trying to like get by and like make everybody happy, or not everybody, but at least somebody happy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and like I was doing another course today, and I was talking about how outside we can see all this construction work happening.
Yeah.
And I was talking about all the things that are going on. And then how I was looking out, I was going like, how do these people all work? How do they all get here? Because, you know, there's 50 people down there, 100 people. And like, some of them are going through divorces. Some of them have illness. Some of them have hurt other people or have been hurt by mm-hmm. other people. And you go like, so how do they get out of bed and get to work? How do we do this? How does the world keep turning? And often it's because we have these defenses, we
yeah.
repress things, we put these things down. And when you start to see that, and then you start to see that people cannot lie. Freud said, he says, if you look at people closely, you'd think it's impossible to lie. Because even if they don't tell you the truth with their lips, they tell you the truth with their tapping finger. Mm. In other words, people are constantly telling you their truth all the time, if you just watch. And the truth is that you can see is that people are suffering and in pain.
Yeah.
And but sometimes do violent things with that suffering. Sometimes they turn it on themselves and they hate themselves, or sometimes they turn it on other people and they hate and damage other people. But when you start to see this, you start to see, you know, how traumatic and difficult it is to live.
It also allows you, I think, to just give yourself a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
You know, like when I have a dark thought or something where I'm just like, oh, that wasn't good or appropriate or nice or loving and da-da-da-da, it's like, oh, well, I'm also this mess of a person trying to please some other in some capacity, you know, make everybody happy. And it's like, I think it makes it a lot easier to go through life when you can cut yourself a little slack. And it also makes you not have to take it so goddamn seriously all the time.
And we all need spaces where we can do that. That's the key. That's for me what liturgy is, by the way. Liturgy is a religious word, I know, but all it means to me is the liturgical space is the space, the rituals we have that allow us to lower our defense mechanisms and be honest and listen to others. That can be, you know, at a pub, and it can be at a coffee shop, it can be anywhere, it can be, but those spaces where we can, you know, put our armor down a little bit,
yeah,
begin to be honest, and we need those spaces. Otherwise we just, you know, become so hardened and that we destroy ourselves or we destroy other people.
Yeah.
Good stuff. All right. Well, everybody, thank you for listening very much. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes and rate it. However many stars you think are appropriate. Anything else you want to say, I think?
No, I mean, just a little takeaway. I'd love to hear your takeaway, and I'll maybe give
I guess takeaway. My takeaway, I mean, I kind of, I think my takeaway would be, as I mentioned before, just to have, it's always like you should have more compassion for people. Everybody gets that. Like, it's one of those things where, you know, you're like, well, I just want to be loving kindness all the time. But I think it helps me kind of, ironically, which I didn't expect in starting the podcast, I didn't expect the end of the podcast to be me feeling compassion for people, especially
because that's a very rare thing for me to see in you.
It's unbelievable.
Wow.
This is actually, can you take a photo of me or something? I don't even know. Is my face different? Am I glowing? Especially something about like fantasies and you think like sexual stuff and like there's like all the jokey joke stuff. But yeah, it's nice to feel to have that kind of like, you learned something from
yeah.
it. But, yeah.
Yeah. And well, and for me, like a little takeaway is to think about, you know, what are your desires? Are there any of them which are actually not desired by you? So, for example, some people are always being so kind and giving, always bring almost too much to the party. They do too much. They're always going above and beyond. But it's because maybe when they were young, that's how they felt they got the desire of others around them, by always giving, giving, giving. And that can be a very painful thing to always be doing that. So are your desires, what desires of yours are oppressive? And then maybe begin to kind of try to become aware of where those desires are coming from. And that awareness can sometimes, not always, but can sometimes ease the burden.
Because I think this is the direction we're going with this podcast. I hope it ends up being that every one of my takeaways is some sort of like, I don't know, I think you should be nicer to people. And then you're like, well, and you say something like far more profound. That's my favorite. Like, yeah, that's
as well.
Yeah, yes, also to what he said. Oh my goodness. All right. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.